before the fact that it was going to be a cafe or a restaurant or whatnot, it was always about building a brand. I mean, I have been fortunate to work with some of the most amazing brands, and let me tell you, the relationship that people have with brands that they, you know, they love, they respect, you know, iconic brands where you have this ridiculous, you know, infatuation, you see yourself in that brand. I just, you know, being a brand, I used to see it on the other side.
For sure.
And it was always fascinating. I mean, you know, if you're a Givenchy girl or you're a Dior girl or a Gucci girl, like, you know, you just stick to that brand. And I
the
used
brand
to,
loyalty is massive.
It's incredible. It's incredible. And the way that brands work in the background to build that loyalty, that positioning, you know, they say a brand is what people say about you when you're not in the room, you know, and you're proud of that brand. And I was always in love with that aspect of it.
Welcome to A Table for Two, inspiring and educational interviews and stories with the best operators, owners, and entrepreneurs in business and the hospitality industry. My name is Phil Halani, and on today's episode, we chat to Christine Elbach, owner of the world's first peanut butter bar. Christine spent 20 years in corporate working at some of the world's top luxury brands in Australia and Dubai. After spending 3 years in Dubai, she decided it was time to come home. She knew her time was up in corporate and decided to chase her dreams of opening her own business. She had worked in hospitality as a teenager and wanted to combine her love for brands, business, and hospitality. Being a lover of all things peanut butter, she decided to open the world's first dedicated peanut butter bar. Her initial concept was to create a dessert bar that focused on offering peanut butter desserts free from refined sugars and preservatives, as well as gluten-free and vegan options that didn't make you feel guilty after eating desserts. Although she received attention from nearly every major media outlet around the world, including a video that was viewed over 30 million times, the sales started to drop. As things got worse, people told her that she gave it a shot, but it was time to give up and close the shop. Christine knew she had something special and refused to give up. She engaged a consultant to help her rebrand the business. She changed the concept. In 2019, Peanut Butter Bar 2.0 was born. I was blown away by Christine's story. Her resilience, drive, and passion for hospitality and building a brand she hopes to take worldwide one day is so inspiring. A quick shout out to our good friends at ProCow Dairies, Sonoma Baking Co. and MD Providors, who are passionate about supporting small businesses, the hospitality industry, and also this podcast. We spoke a little bit off air about, you know, a few things about your journey, which I'm really excited to go a bit deeper into, but I'd love to know about your corporate career before you got into hospitality.
Oh, that's a big story. Yeah, look, Phil, I spent 20 years in corporate. Fortunate enough to work with the French for so long, and geez, I learned a lot from them. I did 4 years with L'Oréal Paris. That was kind of in the early days. I was just a sales rep, but they are absolute market-leading powerhouses, so you learn a lot with them really fast.
Yeah.
And then after that 4 years, I got a job with Givenchy. And Givenchy is actually owned by LVMH, Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy. And that was pretty incredible. So I kind of stayed with Givenchy for about 10 years. And over the journey of the 10 years, they acquired, or they combined with Kenzo, Parfums Kenzo, with Fendi. Ended up going to Dubai as a regional director. Came back, still stayed with LVMH, but was transferred to the liquor division, Moët Hennessy, for 3 years.
And so the journey, like the corporate journey, obviously from outside looking in, it's always so appealing. Everyone, like, you know, you're flying overseas, you lived in Dubai for 3 years. What was that experience like? Like for us looking out, from outside looking in, I'm like, what a job.
Yeah, it's very surreal when I think about it now, actually. I mean, I think I appreciate it more now that I've had a lot of time to reflect and dissect it for what it was. Look, you know, I was very excited. I had never lived outside of Sydney before. You know, I'm born and bred in Sydney, Western
you're
suburbs.
You're a Westie, yeah.
And I'm a Westie.
Represent.
Absolutely. So, look, I'll never forget the day I rocked up or I arrived in Dubai. It was 6 a.m. I arrived at 6 a.m. It was February the 14th. It was Valentine's Day, I think, 2011. And I had, you know, as many clothes as I could pack. The rest of the stuff was being shipped. So I just remember coming off the arrivals hall with, you know, about six different suitcases, absolutely lost, knew nobody, just had an address of a hotel. I mean, it was kind of crazy.
What an experience.
And I actually went to the office that same day.
Wow.
I remember dropping off my bags, having a shower, getting dressed. I was so excited and went, you know, got a taxi and went to the office.
We're going to go a bit back and forth with your corporate career, but what was the one thing that Dubai showed you, that taught you kind of to where you are now?
Resilience that you can pick up and go anywhere and work it out. I mean, I think, the funny thing is, it was achieving the simplest things that gave me a lot of satisfaction. You know, just finding a place to live, or finding where to buy your groceries, where to get your hair done, and it was kind of fascinating because you realize how big the world is, yeah. And how small I was living maybe in Australia. In Australia we tend to live in our little suburb and we shop in the little mall next door and we buy a coffee from the same place, and all of a sudden there's this other country and there's people living and working and moving, and it was kind of weird, just trying to find your place on planet Earth, like in a new place in the world.
Yeah, and you got obviously, you're coming out of your comfort zone, which would have been massive for you coming into... Obviously, you opened this business, we'll talk about, but getting out of your comfort zone, that would probably be the first time, do you feel, that you're out of your comfort zone?
Absolutely. Well, not the first time. I always seem to find myself in... I don't know why. My mother says I just love trouble and love, heartache. But probably the biggest one. Even driving. I remember the first day I had to drive. They drive on the other side of the road. The speed limit is like 120 and everybody drives at like 160.
Yeah.
Everyone's driving ridiculous, $800,000 cars. And I had this little Ford Fiesta. It's very liberating, when you kind of work out every day how to drive, how to park, how to fill petrol. It was a life-changing experience, probably one of the best chapters of my life.
And you were saying you had a bit of backlash when you said you were moving to Dubai from family, friends, saying, what are you doing? What, how can you just pick up and leave? At the time, you had two young kids.
Yeah.
Like, what was that like?
That was one of the toughest, honestly, toughest personal challenges I've ever had. Because I got this job and I just felt like a superstar, and I thought everybody would be so happy for me and so supportive, and it was the opposite. They were like, kind of, congratulations, Christine, that's great, but you're not going. And I'm like, hell yeah, I'm going. And everybody was against me, and I fought with everyone, friends, family, parents. They just thought it was the most ludicrous thing you could ever do. Why would you leave everything? And I thought, well, it's an experience, it's an opportunity, it's come to me.
Yeah.
And nothing's impossible. I mean, look, there's a lot of challenges, getting there, packing up a house and selling cars and, renting your place, and there's a lot of things that happen, but I'm not the first, I'm not the last that's going to do it, but the reward was incredible.
And you said, off air, you're saying it was one of the best things you ever did.
Absolutely, no regrets. It was the most... challenging chapters of my life, most rewarding, besides the physical moving, a family, young kids, your stuff. I mean, I moved my whole stuff, all my furniture, clothes, everything over there. It was the actual challenge of the job itself, working in another country, different cultures. I managed countries I didn't even know how to spell,
Wow.
I mean, I've got a Middle Eastern background, but I didn't know where Oman was and, Bahrain and Kuwait, and then you had to travel and actually do business with these with people from other countries, and deal with the French. We reported into Paris, and it was a regional office, and the French are ruthless. I mean, they are the French for a reason. They are masters at their game. The attention to detail, the way they manage their image and their brands, sales, it's another ball game. So there's a lot of pressure from everywhere, from the market, from the team, from, the office that you're reporting into. So
of course.
It's crazy, but...
So when, I mean, like I said, to work your way up to where you did in corporate is quite admirable, and it's very hard to get to that level you got to. What was the moment that you realized you were done with corporate?
I always tell people this. I used to feel kind of like a zombie. The last 3 years I spent in corporate was with Moët Hennessy, although they're an amazing company. Shout out to all my old colleagues from Moët Hennessy. Amazing, amazing company, the amazing portfolio of brands. I remember having everything. I had an amazing team. I had a fantastic portfolio to work with, a great, customer. I was dealing with Woolworths Australia. Had the, was going to amazing events. Every day I would walk into the office and something would die. I would just drag myself to my desk and sit there, and I was just lifeless. And the day would drag on, and I just couldn't wait to get home and couldn't wait for the weekend. I think that's a really bad sign.
Yeah,
you're just Monday, yeah. You're just suicidal, and Wednesday you're counting down to Friday.
It's, hump day.
Yeah, it's horrible. It's like, oh my God, five yeah. days. That was a really bad yeah. period for me.
So you make the decision, what year was it when you made the decision to get out of corporate?
It was probably a year after coming back from Dubai.
So that 2012,
so I came back in 14, and then, you know, obviously the new job, new company, that was pretty cool, and, you know, sort of finding my groove in a new environment.
Yeah.
And I think the following year, which was 15, I was like, okay, something's wrong. I just couldn't get the same highs as I was getting in Dubai or, you know, in my previous role. And then I realized it wasn't the company. It was just nothing could match the experience of Dubai.
Yeah.
And I just felt, okay, well, I mean, I managed the region. I managed all these countries. I lived overseas. I was traveling. Like, nothing could compare. Like, and I was dead. That's it. I had nothing else to give.
So you make the decision in 2015. Did you leave corporate and then straight away start looking to what you're going to do next?
No. Well, I kind of feel bad saying this, but whilst I was in corporate, my mind was starting to float somewhere
else. It's very normal, yeah. People, obviously, they can't just leave straight away, right?
Like, no. Yeah. And it was a big decision because I'd spent a long time in corporate, and it was my identity, you know? It was who I was. I was the corporate girl. But I started to think, okay, I've got to get out. But where was I going to go? Like, nothing could compare to working with LVMH as well. I didn't want to go to another job or another brand. I was like, you know, these guys are kings of luxury.
Yeah, so you wanted a career change.
I think so. And I was ready to do my own thing. I've always wanted to do my own business or have my own brand, rather. So it took about a year of kind of internal war with myself going, I'm not happy, I need to do something, what is it? And I was just reading and researching and listening to Gary Vee and a whole bunch of other inspirational people out there.
That's awesome. So you while you're working in corporate, you're looking at other ideas, when did the idea for Peanut Butter Bar come up?
I knew what it was going to, what I was planning to do was food, because I have a very small, brief interaction with hospitality when I was a kid, like we all did, right?
Where did you work?
Oh, look, when I was, I think, 14 and 9 months, my first job was at Australia's Wonderland.
Wow.
Do you remember Wonderland?
Do you know what's funny? Whenever I talk about, like, creating new venues and experiences, I always refer back to Wonderland and what it did and how it made me feel when I used to go there.
No way.
Yeah, so, Sydney Wonderland for me was one of my greatest best experiences as a child. So.
Do you know, I didn't realise the impact of that 4 or 5 years, the impact that it had on me till like maybe the last 10 years.
Wow. I think to me about that.
Oh, look, you know, I'm just smiling talking about Wonderland. I mean, I think it was just one of the most happiest places on the planet for 100%. Me as a kid. So I was fortunate that I lived, you know, I'm a Westie. I grew up in Blacktown. And, you know, Wonderland was, you could see it from upstairs, from our house. You could see
the roller coaster.
The roller coaster.
It was amazing.
So, yeah, look, it was my first job. And it was one of the most incredible experiences. I mean, this was a theme park. So as a 14-year-old working in a theme park, I mean, that's already like...
It's a dream.
It's a dream, right? And that was so professional, you know. I still remember induction, and they'd take you around to the park, to every... Remember, it was all segregated in themes. And we used to have to wear this really dicky uniform. I used to work in Hanna-Barbera Land. It was like the Flintstones kind of...
Oh, yeah.
And we used to have this weird uniform we'd have to put on, and it was all little outlets, and, you know, you were stationed in these little outlets. The training was incredible. The funny thing is, I did such a great job. I was so serious about work at such a young age that when I was 17, they promoted me to an OC, an operations controller.
There you go. So you're always getting promoted. And
that was the first sign. And that was really funny because they put me on a contract salary. So I was doing my HSC, I think, back then. Okay. It was a $22,000 a year salary. But for a 17-year-old kid back then, like 30 years ago, that was huge, right?
Yeah.
So I had to do a certain amount of hours. So my hours were pretty much done over the weekend. But then I used to go in, on a Thursday to do the rosters and do stock take. But the park was only open on the weekends.
Yeah. So they gave you a bit more of an experience in regards to systems, procedures,
100%,
all those things.
Absolutely.
And do you think that was a big part? Obviously, you worked in corporate, which we'll talk about, and how that helped you. But what else did Wonderland give you that set you up for hospitality?
Well, actually, the next step, so I eventually left Wonderland. I mean, I did that kind of supervisor role for a while, and it was pretty cool. But then I thought, you know what, I'm ready for the next challenge. I grew up, you know, I wanted to get out of Wonderland. Yeah, yeah. So I actually ended up working for Hungry Jack's for a couple of years in Parramatta.
Okay, in the actual store?
I was an assistant store manager. I was also quite young, like maybe 19 or something. And that was a really significant Hungry Jack's store. I don't know if you recall it. It was on the corner of Church underneath.
Under the bridge.
Under the bridge. And that was, I think it was the second Hungry Jack's store opening in Australia.
Wow.
And it was right in the middle of the massive court case between Burger King and Hungry Jack's.
I remember that, yeah.
And Jack Cohen himself, I don't know if he was a part owner, but he was very closely linked with the guy that owned that Hungry Jack's store. So he would actually come in his big limo and come to the store, Jack. The man, Jack Cohen. Yeah.
What a cool experience that would have been for you to see the owner.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And so, obviously, Hungry Jack's gave you more of insight into hospitality. And
100%.
And so, before you went into corporate, did you say you wanted to do something from back then? Did you want to open your own shop from when you worked in those days, or was it really not a thought?
No, it was a thought back then. I used to think, oh, you know, it's going to be so cool to own a cafe one day. You know, like every kid dreams of a cafe. You know, you're a cafe, you're 100%. On set of cafe game. There's something really romantic and mysterious and magical about owning a cafe. I used to think about it.
Yeah.
But it was just a thought. Yeah. It was just a thought. Because, you know, after that Hungry Jack's experience, my life completely changed. Yeah. I went into cosmetics and luxury brands and working for the French, and I never turned... I mean, it was 20 years of nothing to do with food and hospitality.
And so you start looking for options, things to do. What's next?
Well, it was weird because, you know, when I decided to get out of corporate, for some reason, all I could remember was the high that I used to get in hospitality. You know, what I used to, you know, think, okay, what do I want to do? What makes me happy? What gives me that satisfaction that, you know, I'm doing something, I'm producing something? I never actually forgot the experiences that I had at Wonderland and Hungry Jack's. You know that rush? I mean, you understand, Phil. It's sick, right? Because it's a lot of pain physically, but you know that rush of, you know, the place is packed, there's people everywhere, you get through the rush, you clean the store, you start again, and it's just that constant motion of going, getting through crowds and filling and setting up and cleaning and doing it again.
Biggest high. It's the biggest high.
So it's hard to explain to someone who's not in hospitality, but there's a real deep kind of satisfaction you get from the end of every shift and the end of every day. You know, when you just think, oh, my God, this is complete chaos, and then it's under control.
And you sit down after, you're like, wow, that's amazing. The venue was full. The vibe was great. The staff were on board. Like, it's, yeah, we had that recently with Mother's Day where it was just nearly the most perfect service, and it was one of the busiest days we've ever had. And just to be able to nail every aspect of it was just very special. So I know that feeling. I was smiling when you were saying that that feeling. So when was it the moment where you realized that peanut butter bar came up?
So I definitely, like I said, I knew it was going to be hospitality. I wanted it to be a brand. And I was just kind of looking around in Sydney, what was happening, what was hot, what was not. And I noticed at that point, there was a lot of chocolate stuff happening. And I used to always think, you know, geez, I'm not a chocolate person. I mean, everyone loves chocolate, right? But every time I know myself, every time I go somewhere and they have it, there's a peanut butter flavor, a peanut butter option.
Always go for it.
I don't even look at any other option. It's just a natural, I'll take the peanut butter.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was a bit of a joke at first, thinking, oh, you know, imagine there's nothing, you know, out there that just focuses on peanut butter. Yet there's so many peanut butter options in packaged goods, in food items, in cafes or whatnot. And so I kind of toyed around a bit with that. And every day that idea just kept growing and growing and growing.
And so the idea's growing and being in corporate and seeing all these big brands, it was always an idea that you wanted to create a brand, not just a venue. It was just you wanted to build a brand that you could take global.
100%. I mean, that was always, you know, before the peanut butter thing, before the fact that it was going to be a cafe or a restaurant or whatnot, it was always about building a brand. I mean, I have been fortunate to work with some of the most amazing brands. And let me tell you, the relationship that people have with brands that they, you know, they love, they respect, you know, iconic brands where you have this ridiculous, you know, infatuation, you see yourself in that brand. I just, you know, being a brand, I used to see it on the other side.
For sure.
And it was always fascinating. I mean, you know, if you're a Givenchy girl or you're a Dior girl or a Gucci girl, like, you know, you just stick to that brand. And
the brand loyalty is massive.
It's incredible. It's incredible. And the way that brands work in the background to build that loyalty, that positioning. You know, they say a brand is what people say about you when you're not in the room, you know, and you're proud of that brand. And I was always in love with that aspect of it. You know, we used to see how much products used to cost. You know, I used to I used to take care of the P&L management of my region. So, I mean, I'm not going to reveal it, but, you know, like a bottle of fragrance or a $100 lipstick that we would retail for $100, you will cry if I tell you how much that lipstick costs or that bottle of perfume.
So just open your eyes.
I was like, wow, you know, it's like literally a 2% cost of good.
Wow.
And, you know, the rest is brand loyalty. So that's the power of brands.
Did you, being in products and things like luxury brands, did it make you, before hospitality, did you think you want to create your own product other than the peanut butter bar? But did you ever have that interest or not really?
No. There was nothing, there was no specific product in my mind that I wanted to create. Now it's different, you know, because now that we have a brand or it's still in the early stages, you know, the options are endless. And, I try and create brands or products rather. So I think there's going to be a lot of that in the future. I've got a really big plan and dream in the background. But yeah, now I do.
Yeah.
So now I do.
The things you've been talking about off air about what you're going to do, we'll talk a little bit more about because it's very exciting. Even your products, we're looking at your peanut butter range now and it's pretty amazing. But you said that, you know, you loved peanut butter. You're a big fan of it. How did the idea come from a passion for eating peanut butter to opening to opening a brand? That's like you said, it went worldwide.
Yeah,
I mean the attention was worldwide.
The attention is worldwide, and you know, it's almost like a cult following, to be honest.
It really is.
I get some really crazy requests and messages even from overseas, and people flying from interstate to come here. Look, it started off as a bit of a joke, obviously, peanut butter bar. But like I said, it evolved. It took about a year to evolve.
Yeah.
I had seen brands come up like, you know, Max Brenner, obviously, what they did to the chocolate market for 20 years. Teller started off great when they first started. Obviously, all the hype around the Teller. So I had been exposed to that kind of, you know, the idea of taking something and sort of growing it further. So that I had those kind of things in my mind, I guess, when I started.
Yeah.
But like I said, it kept evolving and it's got our own twists and our own flavor to it now. Mm. But yeah, essentially, it's a place for peanut butter lovers and people who are obsessed with peanut butter.
So let's talk about it. You open Peanut Butter Bar. The concept's different to what it is today.
A little bit. You could say that.
So can you talk to us about what your original concept was? And then we'll talk about why you changed.
Sure. So the concept was all about indulgent wellness. So the idea behind it was to create a range or a space for people who were very focused on health and fitness, but still wanted a treat, still wanted to go out and feel like they were having a guilt-free pleasure, if you like. So we had a tagline, you know, it was powered by protein. And that's because protein was essentially the fundamental ingredient that we used in all our baking.
And at the time, there was no food. It was just dessert.
It was just a dessert bar, yeah. But you know, a dessert bar with a bit of a health kick.
Okay, so what went wrong?
what didn't go wrong, Phil? look, I mean, you know, it was actually, looking back now, I'm so glad that happened. Amazing learnings came out of it. What went wrong is, you know, I thought I had all the answers and it made total sense in my head. And I spent a year kind of putting it together. So it wasn't just like a, you know, crazy idea and I ran with it. I had a lot of data that pointed in the direction of the market being more focused on fitness, and that dessert was also booming at the time. So I pulled a lot of things together, a lot of research. There's a couple of brands in the US that were doing protein peanut butter, and they were booming as well, which I actually ended up importing one of them in. It was called Buff Bake, and we were actually cooking with that.
That was the original peanut butter that you were using, right?
Yeah, that's the original one that we were using, and we were using it as a base for a lot of our baked goods, and we were, you know, importing it from California in, you know, 20 liter drums. It was mad. So yeah, look, there was a lot of thinking and planning. It made sense. But the reality, and it created a lot of hype. I mean, we got so much media, so much hype when we opened. It would be very hard to recreate that, let me tell you. But I don't think it was the protein or the health that created the hype. It was more the peanut butter. But at the time, I was convinced that people wanted healthier desserts.
Okay. And so, you know, you spoke about that hype. You know, you couldn't pay for the amount of publicity that you got. It was unbelievable. All around the world, people talking about, you know, the first world first peanut butter tap, first health peanut butter store. What went wrong? So what was it that, you know, obviously you're getting all this hype. Where did it all go wrong?
A couple of things. I think the message was confusing because, you know, you're doing dessert, but it's a healthy kind of dessert option. It was making people feel uncomfortable in terms of the guilt. You know, when people are eating dessert, they don't want to be reminded that they're off track and they're not being fit. I had a lot of fitness paraphernalia all over the place. You know, I had Rocky images and Arnold Schwarzenegger, Muhammad Ali.
Boxing ring.
So you know what? It attracted a lot of bodybuilders, let me tell you. The boxing universe loved it. A lot of people from the fitness world completely felt at home and comfortable. But the funny thing is, even these guys who are training like crazy, they don't want to go out for protein treats, Phil. They're having protein shakes,
all day.
6 days a week. So when they go out, they want to have a cheat meal. They want to, you know, treat themselves. So my messaging was wrong, I guess, and it kind of it didn't hit the mark because it was not a sustainable concept. You know, people want to go out and have a treat at the end of the day. If you're going to be super healthy, you're going to kind of do that at home in your kitchen, right?
How did it make you feel, Christine, when you realized that it's something you'd been working for a couple of years for, building, and then not like the money's not there, the profit's not there? What was that feeling like?
Yeah, look, it was very humbling. It never broke me, but I was really concerned, I'm not going to lie. I mean, like I told you before, the whole concept was bizarre. I mean, I was open 7 days a week. I had no food. I was open from 11 to 11 and barely paying the bills. But it didn't make sense because the media was hyping. You know, I was getting up to 30 million views on a video.
Wow.
I remember there was one video that went viral. It had over 220,000 comments, and I was up all night reading the comments going, oh my God, I'm going to retire off this thing, you know. But, you know, the reality is people would come try it once, but they wouldn't come back because it was confusing and there was no food, as in savory food. The messaging was confusing. So, yeah, look, it was a really tough period in my life. It was very humbling. It was very worrying, you know, financially. And yeah, it hits your ego, right? Because you've done all this research,
sure.
You've got the greatest idea in the world, and then it doesn't work.
Well, the one thing that comes to mind when I see you and talk to you is resilience. So there was no chance you were going to ever give up. What was the next step for you to realize? Once you realized, hey, this isn't working, what was the next step?
It was a very interesting next step. I actually reached out to somebody. But before I realized I had a problem, I had reached out to a gentleman that had an incredible experience in food and hospitality. I just reached out to him on LinkedIn, and I just wanted to learn from him and ask questions, and I wanted him to see the place and, you know, give me some feedback. And I was very fortunate that he agreed to come, and he was fascinated, but he was very confused as well. And I was like, okay, this is not a good sign. And I was like, you know, trying to oversell it. No, but this, but that, we've had all this hype and it's great. It's the first in the world. And he was like, Christine, look, you got some great stuff happening here, but this thing is literally nuts. Like, there's some really big fundamental issues with it. And thankfully for him, and I owe a lot to him, he initiated a bit of a study, a bit of a marketing health check, and said, look, you know, I really recommend that you do this. And it was basically engaging in a marketing guru. I'm definitely not a marketing guru. This guy knows what he's talking about. And he'll come and assess the business, dissect it, and understand what the hell's going on. And, you know, it was probably the best money I spent in my life. It was a very expensive exercise, but it was the best decision ever.
Because you look at when you spent all this money on a shop, and then you think it's the right idea, and it doesn't work out. Most people either give up, or sell the business or just walk away and say, I'm never doing this again?
Look, I tell you what, you know, I'm not going to mention any names, but the gentleman you told me you met today, just earlier, that also has a very successful business in the street. he was a very interesting person in the journey, because he was watching everything we were doing, the money we were putting in, you know, the hype in the beginning. And at some point there were days where it was like a ghost town in here. And once he said to me, Christine, you gave it a go. There's no, you know, don't feel like you failed. You know, I think you need to sell. You need to close. You need to sell. Cut your losses, basically. And he wasn't the only one. And I remember getting so cut up that day. I'm like, you know, what the hell? I'm not quitting. Like, I'm just getting warmed up. You know, I haven't played all my cards yet.
Of course.
But a lot of people were like, okay, you gave it a go. You know, you did everything you could. There's no, don't be embarrassed to just call it.
But you refused to.
I'm relentless, Phil. I'm like a dog with a bone. I'm pretty stubborn. Like, when I want something, some things don't work. But, you know, I didn't feel like I actually played every card yet.
Okay.
And I knew that there's got to be a way. Like, because I saw too much magic, you know. It wasn't a complete dud and failure. Like, people were flying from interstate to come. You know, New York Timeout featured us. Like, there was some magic amongst the what the hell's going on with the sales. So that was enough for me to go, no, there's something here.
Something's missing, but
there was there was something sparkling in the pile of dirt, if you like, you know. So I was holding on to those kind of little magical things, going, I'll find a way.
That's the real entrepreneur in you. And I think the fact that, because a lot of people wouldn't see what you were seeing, right? Like you said, a lot of people asking why you gave it a shot. Good, well done. Now you can go back to corporate.
Yeah, go back. But my mother always says to me, when are you going to get a real job? Go back and get a job.
So this gentleman that helped you get through, you know, did a market research and go through, kind of, what was it called, a market?
It's a brand health check, if you like.
Brand health check. You said that was probably one of the best things you did, because he came back and he said, all right, what do you do?
Yeah, he came back with a huge study and a huge, you know, feedback from over 100 interviews, Net Porter score, lots of things. And they actually took me away to give me the news. They made me go away to another place, we went to the Central Coast. And they, you know, I was all excited, thinking, you know, he's just going to give me a couple of tips and I'll be on my way, you know. And he basically said, people are coming for the peanut butter and for the atmosphere, and everything else is just noise. It's confusing. It doesn't make sense. People don't get it. You know, it's a complete disconnect.
How do you feel?
I was gutted, Phil. I was gutted. I was, you know, a little bit, you know, the ego, obviously. I had a bit of ego as well. I was like, what do you mean? But, you know, that can't be right. But I actually, I took it pretty well in the end, and I just listened and I thought, you know, this is a chance.
That's amazing. And then, so that was 2019?
That was, that was 18. Okay. So it was kind of early 18. It was the end of 18. And then, so we started 2019 thinking, okay, we've got to change the whole concept.
And so when was it that you actually changed, you rebranded your concept to what it is?
December. So it actually took a year. All of 2019 was spent in denial, going, this can't be happening. I can't believe I got to change everything. Two, convincing people around me that I had to change everything. And three, engaging in people now that could actually help me, professionals that could help me, you know, sort of interpret my vision. I always wanted a communal gathering space, a place where people could hang out, enjoy food, enjoy music, have fun, a brand that they can connect with. You know, those things never changed. It was just the delivery of the message, the original concept, which is kind of what took me off track a little bit.
And so what were the changes that you made that brought us to where we are today?
We went back to basics. You know, it was, okay, peanut butter. We're here because of the peanut butter, you know. And I came up, you know, I did a lot of research and really dug deep as to why did I choose peanut butter to start with. You know, and peanut butter is so much more than just a spread. You know, people are obsessed with it. I know it sounds crazy, but, you know, people who consume peanut butter regularly, it's just like a life staple. And, you know, I came up with this cool thing, you know, taking your love for peanut butter beyond the jar, because that's essentially what we were trying to do. We were trying to show the world that it doesn't just have to live on your toast.
Okay.
You know, the versatility behind peanut butter, the good, great health benefits around peanut butter, and making it fun, you know, getting it out of the jar, using it as an ingredient, engaging with it.
Yeah.
And that's how we kind of developed the concept, and it was around love, you know, the love of peanut butter, the love of connecting with people, the love of a place that you want to hang out with. So we used the word love a lot. And then, you know, we came up with the butter love thing because butter love represents so much.
I love that. I love that. And I just, one of the, I was very excited for many reasons to come and interview you today and see your shop. And but I love the amount of effort you put into your branding. How important is that? Because you want to create a brand. So how important, what have you done? What are the things you've done to make sure your brand is so recognizable across the world?
Look, it's always a work in progress. I think I was very clear in the beginning with the values that it represents. You know, it's fun, it's joy, it's connection. And everything that we do always has to go back to those core values around the love of peanut butter. But it's a fun energy, you know. So, you know, even with social media, because I manage my own pages, believe it or not, I always try to make it fun and energetic and all about love and connection. It's a fun product, you know. It's not a serious product. Yeah. It's a fun product, but it represents a lot of things.
So your product now is a dessert bar with food.
Not dessert bar anymore.
Dessert bar.
It's a diner. It's an American diner. Yeah. It's a peanut butter. It's the world's first peanut butter diner. So we are a diner now because we have a savory menu.
Was the savory a big part of the success of where you are today?
Yeah, absolutely. The rebranding and the new concept launch, if you like. I mean, a huge anchor of it is the savory. I mean, you wouldn't believe it. I actually just ran an analysis report last month, and our number one seller is the PBB burger now.
Wow.
Which is the first time it's shifted from the skillet, the cookie skillet.
So essentially your concept with most of your food items have an element of peanut butter in it, something peanut butter.
Yes and no. I mean, it's not an overkill peanut butter
offer
either.
Of course, yeah, of course.
Because I am aware that, you know, you could come with some friends, you know, three out of four of you like peanut butter, but there's one guy that's not interested in peanut butter. So we give people the option of flexing up and flexing down with the pour. Poor jars, but it's a peanut butter twist, we like to call it.
Yeah, because like you said, there's going to be people that come in that they want to just enjoy a burger without overkill peanut butter. But like you said, it's a bit of a cult following here, isn't it?
Well, you know, the name on the door says it all. So if you're not really into peanut butter, but I'll tell you a funny story. I don't know if you saw a couple of weeks ago, I got a bad Google review from this guy. He gave me 3 stars because he said, even though he enjoyed the food, he doesn't like peanut butter.
So what are you doing here?
So yeah, so I actually posted it. I reposted it, and I was like, "Dude, like, explain." I mean, it's called peanut butter bar. So essentially, if you don't like peanut butter, and further to that, we get people who are actually allergic to peanut butter that come, and peanuts.
Wow.
This is how crazy this thing is, and they say, "Look, we're allergic, but we wanted to check you guys out. What can we have that doesn't have peanut butter?" And I always say, like, leave. You know, everything is contaminated.
Yeah, you want to be safe, right?
Yeah, but it's, yeah.
And so how did you, when you rebranded, well, essentially same name, but obviously change your menu and change, become more of a diner, how did you get the name out again? Because obviously by then the hype, was the hype still high?
We were still doing pretty good on socials. So the one great thing that we've had, you know, we've been blessed with is the sharing of content, and people, like, our customers are amazing. They're sharing content constantly, and people always seem to want to sort of write about it because it is unusual to have a peanut butter dedicated eatery.
For sure.
Apparently, it's the first in the world.
Yeah, 100%.
So, you know, we've never had issues there in terms of the awareness and the movement of information, sharing of content. So the name has always been present. But obviously, you know, we created a whole campaign around the relaunch and the 2.0 and the addition of the burger menu. And also we did a very American style. We actually got an American chef in who was a consultant for us. And we built the whole American classic diner favorite menu. And we had we also got a liquor license and did a couple of cool cocktails around peanut butter as well. Keep it light, keep it fun. It's fun food, you know. We try and do it at the absolute best of our ability in terms of quality ingredients. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, it's not fine dining. You know, they're fun, good quality, good tasting burgers, wings, loaded fries, shakes,
Lots of love.
It's fun and love, really, at the end of the day.
I love the fact that how passionate you are when you talk about it. Like, you just, the smile hasn't been, you know, you can't get the smile off your face, so, which is amazing. Talking about social media, how important has social media been for the success of your business?
I would say fundamental, if I'm totally honest. And the funny thing is, I'm really an amateur, to be honest with you, with social media. I mean, I came into the game really late. I think I only opened my own page like mid-30s or late-30s. So, and I manage it myself, which is a real interesting thing.
Have you ever thought about outsourcing, or you love it because it's your own personal touch?
I don't know if I love it or hate it, but it's my voice, or it's rather the voice of the brand. So I did give it to somebody for a very short period early on, and I found myself just doubling the work because I would...
Micromanaging, right?
Yeah, why did you use that word? Like, I'd call her and say, I don't like that photo, or you should have used that word, or, you know, that's not really the tone of the brand. So then even, you know, my daughter, sometimes I ask her to post, and she says to me, I don't want to touch it, because whatever I do, you're not going to be happy with it.
Yeah.
So it's a real... it's fundamental because it's the way we connect with our audience. And I'm very fortunate, again, that it's a very engaged relationship. You know, people are commenting, people are sending me messages, resharing. It's super cool. And we've had some amazing people, amazing influencers, celebrities, TikTokers, you name it. It's
so cool. The reality is, you know, it's... You've created a real brand because people are coming back. They're not just coming in to take a photo. And you've created a brand where people want to be part of and want to come back to. And now that you've got that savory menu, it's there's a good balance there. So, yep. What was it in corporate that helped you in hospitality?
I don't know if it helped me to get into hospitality, but it's given me some really good disciplines. I think, you know, the corporate journey was amazing in terms of, you know, respecting disciplines, respecting processes, you know, being diligent with certain things. I do try, and I still run it a bit like a corporate kind of, I run myself like as if I'm still in corporate, if you know what I mean. So I'm very accountable to myself.
There's a lot of disciplines that you have to learn in corporate that you can bring over to.
Absolutely. You know, there's deadlines, there's things that need to hit the market by a certain time. The communication has to be very clear. You know, the whole branding elements, I think, that I picked up from corporate are, you know, priceless. I mean, I've got a long way to go. I'm still a real rookie in this game, but the disciplines are incredible. You know, showing up every day, you know, having, you know, I don't have a boss that I'm answerable to, but the customers, you know, the audience is who I'm answerable to.
Sure.
So if I do something that's not cool, that, you know, they let me hear it, whether in commentary on socials, or they just don't buy the product, or they just don't turn up. You know what I mean? So they're essentially, that's my boss. That's who I'm reporting to every day.
And coming from a culture of corporate, there's a lot of backstabbing, and it's, you know, there's a lot of people higher up, and, you know, you want to, there's favorites. What was it like learning the culture in corporate, then coming in and starting your own culture in hospitality?
Yeah, that was really interesting, actually. Especially in hospitality. Look, one huge thing that shocked me in the beginning is that I just assumed that this world would work like the corporate world, in the sense that, you know, Phil, with hospitality staff and the hospitality universe, sometimes people don't show up. They won't tell you if they're running late.
Never happened.
You know, like, I mean, I had a pretty high position, and I would still let someone know if I was running 10 minutes late out of courtesy. I'd be like, you know, I'm late, I'm stuck in traffic, or, you know, I'm not coming in today, or whatever. That stuff doesn't necessarily always happen in corporate. I just feel like it's a bit looser in terms of the controls of people. Hospitality people tend to do what they want to do sometimes, and I can't generalize, but it's just when you're in that corporate environment, everyone's pretty much on a mission, or on, you got to produce a certain amount of output, certain amount of work, and then there's consequences. I mean, there are consequences in hospitality, don't get me wrong, but as you know, like, stuffing is very tricky. You got to let a lot of things go. You can't expect everyone to be performing at the same level, you know. It's tricky.
It makes it hard because a lot of people in hospitality, you know, which is fine, they don't want to make it a career. And corporate is a different thing where people want to work, you know, work their way up the ladder and things like that. So how have you been able to deal with that?
how have I been able to
deal
with
it? Deal with. I mean, yeah.
I'm still dealing with it.
Every day, right?
I've had to change a lot of expectations. So I just assumed that everybody in this business will want to work the same way I work.
Yeah.
And that was a really big mistake, because at the end of the day, it's my brand and I'm working, you know, at the pace that I'm working at, because I'm excited. It's my baby. It's my passion. And then I was very confused when, you know, the chef wasn't working at the same pace, or, you know, mistakes would happen and he'd be blasé, or, you know, a cashier would not really care about a mistake. You know, I was really confused by that in the beginning. But I've had to change myself. No one's going to ever, and you would know too, Phil, with your baby, you know, I think you can train people and teach them a certain way and what your expectations are, but they'll never really actually do it or execute it the way you do it. Because, like you said, it's a transient thing for them. It's a casual thing for them. Yeah. It's just I need cash thing for them. No one's really invested the same way that we would be.
Yeah, you get the few that want to make it a career, but then you got the rest of the people that are, you know, which is totally fine. They just want to do it during university or high school job or whatever.
Exactly.
So, which makes it hard, but at the same time, it's part of being in business, isn't it? So.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's navigating through. Yeah. It's a tricky one. I don't have all the answers yet, but I'm still working through it.
Working on it. And being in the industry that you're in hospitality, and obviously, like you said, a lot of social media interest, how do you stay relevant and keep attracting people to your business?
Always come up with new stuff. I try and be as creative as I possibly can. You know, people get bored. You know, the audience gets bored. The attention, it's very hard to stay, keep the attention of people now. So I try and keep things funny and light and relevant, you know, current memes, current topics, lots of music, because I love music, so I try and throw a bit of music in there. New news is always, you know, interesting and important for people. You can't just have something that works and just keep banging on about it. They don't care after a while. You get bored as well, right?
Yes.
It's just, you know, it's whatever we like. I mean, think of, put yourself in that position. I mean, and the funny thing is, I do follow a lot of accounts that just keep repeating the same thing, and eventually you're just scrolling, you're scrolling, you're scrolling, you don't care anymore.
Yeah.
So I try and sort of balance. I have a thing called that I like to call the three E's: engagement, education, and entertainment. I try and nail those three E's as much as I can over the week. You entertain people by sharing funny things. You engage by, you know, sexy photos of food, of course, making it really seductive to the eye, and you know, you're educating to a certain degree, you know, some fun facts, new news, new information. So I try and balance those three E's as much as I can.
That's some great advice for people listening as well, to understand, like, when you're through social media or any platform that you're trying to get an audience. You know, hospitality is one of those things. Every industry you have highs and lows, but hospitality, I find that people struggle a lot because it's a hard industry. What kind of mental struggles have you been through, and how have you got through them?
A lot. More mental struggles, I think, in the last 4 years than I ever had in corporate. And the crazy thing is, I thought corporate was like the toughest thing I've ever experienced in my life, honestly. And especially the 3 years in Dubai, there's a lot of pressure. I was accountable for a lot of things, you know, millions of dollars, big teams. And I really thought that was going to crush me. But I look back now and I think that was a walk in the park.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay, so hospitality, it starts off with a dream. You put your money on the line, you put your ideas out there, you want it to work. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. It's not always consistent, you know, as I'm sure you would agree. The highs are really high and the lows are really low. And it always changes, you know, even when you sort of nail something, it goes off course again.
Yeah.
It goes great for a while, then it plateaus, then it goes bad, then it goes great. And that started to mess with me a little bit in the last couple of years. And you kind of doubt yourself, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. Maybe I shouldn't have done this. It's taken a while to get in better control, and I think I am now. And I realize now it's a long game. You know, nothing happens overnight.
Yeah.
You've got to play the long game. If you believe in it, and you're very clear in terms of what you want to achieve on the other end, the ups and downs will always mess with your mind, but you just gotta, it's like a graph, you know, you gotta look at the end.
Have that end goal in focus, and that way there, no matter what happens, you know that it's a long term.
Yeah, I mean, it's never going to be smooth. So if it was going to be smooth sailing, everybody would do this, right?
So true.
And everybody would stay open and never close their doors. And, you know, it's not easy. It's not for the, look, hospitality is not for the faint-hearted.
Yeah.
Right? And as we were discussing before, resilience and problem solving. I think if you can nail those two, because every day, I mean, problems are crushing.
Yeah.
And at the volume, at which the problems come in at as well, small or big, you know, small from, you know, this thing, this item broke to, you know, big, like, you know, your chef has a meltdown and decides to not turn up for the shift. I mean, it's just a continuous barrage of problems. So if you are agile enough to solve problems constantly and not let it crush you, you get through it.
So a lot of the mental struggles, do you find that you... Did you talk to anyone, or was it more just you getting yourself out of that kind of rut that you were in and just kind of pushing forward and pushing forward? Because you are very resilient.
Yeah, look, I'm very blessed. Maybe because I grew up in Blacktown. I had to be... I'm Middle Eastern growing up in Blacktown, yeah, in the 80s and the 90s. You have to be resilient hanging out at Blacktown Station. Look, I think the Dubai experience made me very resilient. You know, being in a foreign country, just kind of trying to create a safe space for your family and find a home and be successful at the job that they pulled you out of your country to do.
Yeah.
I every day would talk to myself and say, you got this, you can't fail, you got this, you can't fail. And I think that experience, the fact that I was able to go in it, survive it, thrive during it and come out of it, gave me a lot of confidence. I never have all the answers, but I know that I'm tough enough to work it out.
Yeah, and it shows, you know, obviously, like you said, the original plan for Peanut Butter Bar was completely different, but you got yourself through that, and it's very inspiring to watch, Christina, so you should be proud.
Borderline madness, stupidness, and stubbornness.
We have to be in the industry. What's it been like? You obviously work with your family, your partner, your kids. What's it been like working with them in the industry?
Terrible. Don't do it. Anyone who wants to get into business with their family, don't do it. Look, it's tricky. It's very taxing on the family dynamic. There's a very big price that you pay, because when you're fully committed to something, like we were saying, you know, you've got all the eggs are up in the air, some eggs fall and break. It's tough. It's tough. And I think it's nice to keep life separate from work.
It's very hard though, right?
It's hard, yeah. That's why I could say that. You know, when everything's kind of crossing over, there's no clear boundaries and there's no clear definitions of my world, your world, our world. So it is tricky, but we're going to be fine. Everything is, you know, everything has a solution. We work through it.
And how do you keep that balance? Are you still working on it?
I'm still working on it. No, look, it's better now. It's better now, yeah. Way better. I mean, awesome. Geez, we've come a long way from year one, year two, year three, year four. I do a lot of alone time as well now. I've learned that, you know, for me to stay on the plan, because I've got a ridiculous dream feel. Like, I wish it was just on this shop and, you know, just create a beautiful brand and a beautiful shop. But I've got a lot of dreams that I want to fulfill. So they're going to take a long time, and I realize that in order for me to stay on track, I just got to spend a lot of time on my own as well and not get bogged down with a lot of the daily noise happens, because then everything looks, you know, uncomprehendable and messy and crazy, and you're so focused on the small details. I've pulled back a lot from the small details, and I found that that's really helpful.
Well, like you said, it's a long game, right? So
yeah.
So knowing what you know now, if you had to start again 5 years ago, would you still do everything that you've done?
Wow. I would have just opened some e-com business online, you know, sold some cute little, I don't know, books or something, candles. Look, I would definitely do it again, maybe do it differently. I would have done it earlier. I'm 45 now and still, you know, but I still feel really energetic and I still feel like I got a long road ahead of me.
Your energy is amazing. It's very inspiring.
Thank you. But my only regret is I didn't start earlier. I think I'm energized by the whole fact that I'm on a mission. I'm on a pursuit of a quest, you know. Yeah. I've got a purpose that I'm kind of living for. I wish I had left corporate earlier, but I was really enjoying corporate, I'm not going to lie. Like, it ticked all my boxes.
Yeah.
So I didn't feel the need to jump off the boat earlier, but I've never been happier chasing something.
Yeah.
So I just wish I started earlier. But hey, it's okay.
Everything happens for a reason. So who inspires you in the industry?
Who inspires me in the industry? You, Phil.
Come on. This is a setup. It's a setup.
Come on. You've done some amazing things, what you've done in Penrith.
Thank you.
What you're doing with your new project. What you did during COVID really spun me out. I think that was...
You know, we had no choice, right? We had to. I mean, kind of like what you did. You had to kind of figure out a way to keep, you know, survive. So.
Yeah. No, it was amazing. And you've got an amazing community, what you've built. You've got a cult following up
there.
Thank
you. I'm very proud.
It's pretty cool.
Very, very proud. Cool. Thank you. What's some advice you give to people wanting to get into the industry?
Into hospitality?
Yeah.
Don't go in it for a bit of fun. Like, you really need to have two fundamentals, and that's resilience and desire. You know, there has to be a really strong, deep desire because, you know, I know it sounds cliche, but look, it's not easy. It's physically not easy. It's financially not easy. And it doesn't happen overnight. So if you really believe in what you're doing, don't go, oh, I just want to open another cafe and make great coffee, because everyone, like, there's so many great cafes that make exactly. great coffee. You know, there has to be a very deep well of desire to do something different or unique, and just be ready for the no's and the problems.
For the craziness. How do you, talking about problems and no's, and how do you deal with bad reviews?
wow. This is a bit of a sensitive one for me, because I think because we're so under the public eye, if you like, and people know who we are, a lot of people like to leave reviews, which I really appreciate, especially if they're constructive, Phil. If they're constructive, I love them. And, you know, we have a lot of learnings and we have a long way to go. There's been a lot of nastiness as well, and very unfair reviews, and that used to really bog me down. We get a lot of amazing reviews. I mean, I think overall on Google, we don't have a great rating. It's 4.3 or something like that. But, you know, a lot of people think it's okay to give a one-star review. And, you know, we're never a one-star. I mean, a one-star is really dismal experience from A to Z, right? Mm. But, you know, one thing could have set them off, you know, like a cup was dirty, or, you know, their wings were late, or their coffee was cold, and they just give the whole experience a one star. That's really damaging. It's gut-wrenching, because, you know, no one really sees the blood, sweat and tears, the heartache, the sleepless nights, the, you know, the complete constant pressure that happens behind the scenes to make it look so seamless and so clean and so organized, you know. So they come in, one thing goes wrong, they give you a one star, three star, two star. I still kind of take it personally, but I'm a little bit more kind of, I try and be a bit more neutral about it now. There was a phase that I was kind of responding to everybody, and I was a little bit, you know, I keep it respectful, but sometimes I say, you know, some people come and complain because it's too loud. You know, the music is too loud.
But that's your vibe.
That's our vibe. You know, we pump the music. It's a hangout. And sometimes I'd say to them, look, this venue's not for you. You know, there's quieter cafes down the street.
Yeah.
You know, this is a vibey place. It's high energy. You know, I love high energy, and my place is high energy. I get lots of good, lots of bad. I'm dealing with it, Phil. I'm still dealing with it.
Of course,
I
it's
still
never don't, easy.
Yeah. Like, how do you deal with it? Like, how do you...
I kill them with kindness.
Ooh.
Always, always. Because I find that the minute I start fighting back, then they want it's like fueling the fire, right? Mm-hmm. They just want to keep pushing it. So for me, I'm always like, cool, you had a bad experience. Shoot me a message, here's my number. And that way there, it shows we care, which we do.
Yeah.
I mean, end of the day, it's all constructive criticism. It's hard when you know you've done everything possible and they don't want to listen. They're just happy to give it one star. Some people are happy being unhappy, but I'm never going to drop to their level. That's one thing I've learned to make sure, because at the end of the day, if I keep fighting it, then it's going to make me feel worse and worse. So I struggle with reviews a lot, and that's a big reason why I ask, because I love to see everyone's reaction to how they deal with reviews. But it's always been a hard thing.
But I mean, you've been in hospitality way longer than me. Do you find that now it's just become like this horrible negative weapon that people use? Like, they get irked and they just...
It's a lot easier to write a review, but I think at the end of the day, it's when you look at overall, you see we focus on the one negative over the 10 good, right? So I think for us, it's just constantly, it's a great opportunity for us to keep learning and growing, but I it's so easy to leave a bad review. Like, how can we screen these reviews and find out what are genuine? Some people, it might be a competitor. It might be someone that someone just had literally, like you said, one bad experience in the whole hour, and they just, they're picking on that. So,
and there's a bit of, you know, unfortunately there's a bit of tall poppy syndrome in this country as well. And a lot of our reviews start off with, I came because of the hype, but I was really disappointed. And they give you, you know, a 3-page essay on their experience. I mean, it's not rock pool. It's a, you're spending $25 a head diner, but then they're critiquing bang, 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 bang. And I just think, okay, because there's hype and because, you know, people kind of share our content doesn't mean that you have the complete right and autonomy to go, I'm going to critique this place like I'm spending $180 a head, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Like, and yeah, it makes it very hard. And I think I look at it and I think to myself, there's got to be a better screening process for reviews. But at the end of the day, we just got to kind of live with it, right? But it's just so hard to see when you've worked so hard for something and you get that 1-star or 2-star review and puts you in shock. I remember my first one, I think I slept for a week.
Well, you are certainly not a 1-star venue, and this is certainly not a 1-star venue. So, you know, I don't think anyone is really deserving of a 1-star review. I mean, that's really harsh when you break it down. That's like, you know, you're sitting on the gutter, your food was terrible, service was terrible, like from A to Z was a dismal experience, which I think is not...
Yeah, it's very unfair. Fair. So let's talk about what's next for you, because I know we've got big plans.
Ah.
Very big plan. I don't know what you can tell us, how much you can tell us, but obviously you got some big plans for Peanut Butter Bar. Can you talk to us about anything?
Yeah, look, there's the coolest thing that I've loved about this journey is that I'm never bored, and every day is full of surprises and opportunities and cool things that happen. Last week we had a film clip, a video clip filmed here.
I seen that on Insta.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Very cool. That was really cool. And so that song's going to get released next week. There's always cool things happening. Got some very exciting news happening next month. We're about to collaborate with a whiskey brand,
cool.
A peanut butter whiskey brand. I can't tell you who yet, but it's going to be really cool. They're going to make this their brand home, their Australian brand home.
Wow.
And we're doing a whole menu around the products, media launch, lots of cool things. So I'm very excited about that. Look, ultimately, 2021 is the year to scale. I mean, it was supposed to happen last year, right? But we had a little surprise curveball. So I'm currently just waiting for the right opportunity to scale, to open our next shop. Very excited about that day. We still haven't found anything yet. There's a few things that we're looking at. But hopefully by the end of the year, you're going to hear some good news, Phil.
And the ultimate place you want to open?
Ooh.
Well, we can't discuss that yet.
It's a surprise.
Surprise, okay.
It's a surprise. Leave that one in your back pocket.
Well, when you're ready to launch that, we'll
closer to where I came from.
Okay. Before we wrap up, is there anything? I got one more question, but before I wrap up, is there anything else you think I should have asked you that you want to add to this podcast that can add value to anyone listening?
Oh, look, I think that we've covered a lot today. That was pretty
cool.
Awesome.
And
I think maybe the why question. I mean, a good friend of mine asked me a while ago, you know, why? Why did you open the Peanut Butter Bar? And I gave him an answer, and he kept digging for more. But why? But why? But why? And I was like, I've already told you. But it was so funny because with every why, I got deeper and deeper into the reason why. And I think that's a really interesting thing when you sort of understand people's why they do this kind of business.
So why do you do what you do?
What do I do? Do you want the first answer or the fourth one? I think it was a real personal challenge for me to create a brand and to sort of prove it to myself. And I think after I turned 40, I was like, I need to do something. I need to do one last interesting thing. And I really wanted I wanted to do something that would make my kids proud as well.
And are they proud?
No, not yet. They're still they're teenagers, Phil. Your kids are still young. One day you'll be teenagers, and it's very hard to impress teenagers.
Yeah, well, my kids at the moment, because they're only 6 and 3, they give them a baby chino and marshmallows and they're stoked.
You're the best dad in the world.
100%. Obviously, my final question on every podcast is from Guy Raz, how I built this. And he asks, how much of your success do you put down to good luck and how much to hard work?
I think... You know, good luck trumps everything. Hard work trumps everything. I think hard work breeds good luck. Hard work breeds opportunities. Luck and opportunities don't come unless you've been working hard to build something in the background. I mean, I wish if I had good luck, this thing would have worked with my protein concept, right? Because I had everything set, but, you know, it didn't work. So, yeah, absolutely hard work. But, you know, you do definitely need a bit of good luck. But opportunities only come once you plant the seeds, so.
Through the hard work.
Absolutely.
Well, what a podcast. So much fun. Thank you. I know we've been talking about getting this done, and I'm so glad that, like, I'm on a high at the moment. So thank you for your time,
Christina.
And I can't wait to release this podcast.
So. Awesome. It was great chatting with you. Thanks so much for coming.
Cheers.